On the next Mind's Eye Radio, it's favorite body parts. We're used to thinking of ourselves as entire creatures, whole systems pumping along inside us, slogging along the trail of life with the foot bone connected to the leg bone connected to the knee bone, and so on, until we put our whole selves in and can do the hokey pokey. But what? What if someone asked you to choose among all your various contributing parts? Find out what the Mind's Eye Radio writers have to say in Favorite Body Parts or... Hey, you want a piece of me? On the next Mind's Eye Radio, it's radio within reach.
As Adam, early in the morning, walking forth from the bower, refreshed with sleep, behold me where I pass, hear my voice, approach, touch me, touch the palm of your hand to my body as I pass. Be not afraid of my body. That was the poem As Adam, Early in the Morning by Walt Whitman.
We're used to thinking of ourselves as entire creatures, whole systems pumping along inside us, slogging along the trail of life with the foot bone connected to the leg bone connected to the knee bone, and so on, until we put our whole selves in and can do the hokey pokey. But what if someone asked you to choose a really terrible but fairly whimsical kind of Sophie's choice among all your various contributing parts? Even though they'll probably never be asked to choose between their noses and their eyebrows, today's Mind's Eye contributors ponder the choice and come up with some interesting responses on favorite body parts or, hey, you want a piece of me?
Some years ago, when I was living in Maine, sharing a house with a small family of four, and wondering which direction I would nudge my ever-erratic life, I got a call from my mother in New York. Now, you need to know that unless it's Christmas or my birthday, a phone call from my mother means someone has died or suffered some dire consequence. But this is just fact, not a criticism of Mom. If I had six adult children, I'd probably let them be the ones who did the calling. Your father cut off his finger yesterday, she nervously announced, and then with the 50 years' experience of being a carpenter's wife added, but don't worry, he's okay. Jesus, was as much as I could manage, mostly because her news had initiated my normal physical panic response. Lightning bolts of pain shooting through my forearms, into my palms, and out to the tips of my fingers. My only explanation for this strange phenomena is that my hands have long existed close to the edge of disaster. 30 years of running pine boards past 10-inch, 1,000 RPM saw blades. Or feeding rough oak into even faster planer blades. Or endless close calls with knives, hatchets, nail guns, sawzalls. 30 years of embedded somatic knowledge. A knowledge that now, on the phone, hearing about my dad's miscue, had released like a psychotic break, charging to the surface of my skin. It mattered not that my dad lived 500 miles away. Hundreds of years of Norwegian carpenter genes carry a much longer way. When a boy is born into our family, it's not the eyes or nose or ears that people comment on. It's the hands. And regardless of the fact that they may be wrinkled little stubs of pink, they are deemed good carpenter hands, a fact that, even though far-fetched, no one ever questions out loud. But for me, it was true. I was born with truly good hands, a fact that by 15 or 16 I knew, and my dad confirmed by pulling me aside, telling me that I had the touch, the true hands, better than my older brothers. And with these words, Dad anointed me to the higher calling, much deeper than any priest conferring confirmation or dean handing me a diploma. And with this blessing, or curse, came the reins to the construction business, if I so chose. So how did it happen? I asked my mother. Dad was 65 at this point, and my mind ran quickly through his shop full of new and ancient tools, all capable of quickly dismembering him. "The wood splitter," she answered. "The wood splitter," I said. Such cruel irony. No doubt he had let his guard down, was dead bored with the crudeness of splitting logs, and was dreaming of working with finer tools, with more refined wood. I recalled Dad's unmitigated instructions to me and my brothers, in case such an event happened to us. Just tell the doctor you don't care what it looks like, as long as it works. "Did they save it?" I asked next, but by then my emotions had caught up with my shock and my tears began to spill out. "No," my mother answered, her voice also breaking. "It was too crushed." "Jesus," I said again, feeling shakier and more nauseous by the second. "Which one?" "His pointer, on his right hand." I blanched, almost passing out. His business hand. Suddenly, in my imagination, my own pointer was gone, and my mind reeled with the disability. How would I guide the handsaw, balance the hand plane, pull the trigger on the circular saw, or perhaps, on a deeper level, point out the direction of my life or my way home? I slumped to the kitchen floor, gripping the phone like a lifeline, unable to speak or put it down. I received that phone call 15 years ago, at a time when I was actually pulling away from the trades, leaning on the shaky structure of my newly acquired psychology degree. I wanted to be done with the working class. But that day on the phone with my mom, I could not deny my roots. Imagining Dad's severed pointer, all that he had lost in that one unconscious moment, it all seemed to catapult me past whatever disagreement that had kept us far apart in my adult years. I knew what he had lost. It hurt. Still, though, probably because my other roots are that of a pure-blood Norwegian, I stubbornly carried on my tangential career path, first as a therapist, then a teacher, now a writer. But interestingly, I never seemed to find full-time work in those occupations, regularly taking out my tools, doing side jobs to supplement my income, building some walls, trimming some windows, creating an oak staircase. A few years ago, I read a line in a poem. "If you feel like dying, use your hands." I know without those so-called side jobs, without keeping my saws sharp and my tools organized, without giving my hands, as the Ojibwe say, good works to do, the other more cerebral occupations would have done me in a long time ago. I also know that, in the end, it's not just working with wood that keeps my hands happy. Cradling my daughter, stroking her hair, catching her tears with my fingers is always sweet recompense for many of life's aches and pains. We're climbing trees and rocks, and I still do at 50, reaching skyward for the next crusty branch of an oak or maple, the next flinty outcropping, pulling myself above houses, people, life. Or even better, reaching around my lover, the other from behind, my hands finding palmfuls of warm heat, gently guiding my wrist, my palms, my fingers like a riverbed. My hands remember what's important, what's essential to living happy, and thankfully alerting me to dangers beyond my mental machinations. And as for my father, now 80, he of course went back to the shop, now pulling the saw trigger with his middle finger, trusting the hand plane to guide itself, and in the process doing ever finer work the older he gets. It will take more than a lost finger to slow him down. And besides, he gets good mileage with his grandchildren, teasing them by sticking his missing finger halfway up his nose. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Norma Gay Pruitt hunkers down and listens when the very popular medical moments appear at the end of the evening news. From hair dye to refrigerated air, our vanities and daily basic habits are clearly out to get us. But if asked what she would least like to sacrifice, she casts her vote to the old think tank in Mad About My Brain.
Casting about to try to choose my favorite body part, I had to finally settle on my brain. It's not that I think mine is such a national treasure. It has served me well, and I'm not ashamed of it, but it's not a genius's brain or anything approaching that. But I find that I am just a little more protective of it than I am of other vital organs, like my heart, for example. Statistically, I know I'm far more likely to die of heart disease, since it's what all of my grandparents succumbed to and what now afflicts both my parents. Yet I have made only perfunctory motions toward cutting down on cholesterol and doing those other things that doctors recommend for hearty heart health. But let me just get one whiff of a story about some brain-deteriorating disease, and I'm off the charts with alarm. For example, following the first mad cow panic in 1977, I quit eating beef immediately. Not just brats and hot dogs and those already suspicious parts, but the whole genus and species. I scan labels very carefully to make sure there's no offending trace. So I felt saddened, but just a little smug, when the most recent scare arose. It seemed to justify what some of my friends saw as my mostly exaggerated fear response. However, I went right on chowing down on chicken and pork, knowing full well about the horrifying conditions in many poultry and pork rendering plants, as well as the terrifying kinds of chemicals and antibiotics which are cavalierly fed to those animals. Subsequently, I began to wonder why the one scourge sent me into strict avoidance mode, while I continued in other sorts of risky behaviors as if immune to the laws of probability. I think I have the answer, and if this comes as a bit less than startling revelation to you, spare me the well, duh. The brain is where I locate myself. If soul or spirit exists, I don't imagine that essence dwelling in any other part of my body. The immune system probably should get greater credit than the brain for being the really most necessary part of my body, which is what makes the myriad diseases of immunity so fearsome. In my case, I have no fewer than 3 active autoimmune conditions, so far being held in check by a host of medicines and treatments. Any of these ailments could and may kill me. And I eagerly scan the medical minutes segments of the news for breaking stories on advances in the field of curing these insidious, traitorous diseases, which have the gall to turn my defense systems against myself, acting as if they don't recognize their own cousin cells. You see, I imagine my body in a kind of Disney Incredible Voyage manner, but none of them to date have the ability to petrify me the way that brain-eating spongiform encephalopathy thing does. The imagination refuses to fill in the blanks on this one. It's cold sweat material for me. I know I'm not the only one who feels this way. Just this past summer, Ted Williams and his son shocked the nation by revealing that he intended to have himself frozen in the hopes that at least his noggin can be maintained far enough into the future so that he can be, here I have to admit, I'm not sure what he imagines, that his head can be retrofitted with a new body? While I grant him the right to dream, it's difficult to see where this is going to get him. But I understand the impulse. I doubt very much if it's because he prizes his fine profile or handsome brow so much. I'll bet it is all about the cerebrum. Supposedly, Timothy Leary had what was left of his thinking apparatus similarly preserved. But that might just be urban legend. The uproar surrounding this poor woman in Florida who is now lying in the cage of a non-functioning body, but whose brain may or may not be sparking, is another case in point. Is she really living? Should her seedy-sounding husband win the right to let her go, or should her family prevail? I don't know. I had this discussion the other night at my women's book group, where all weighty matters ranging from knitting to national politics are parsed and ruled upon. All around me, women held forth firmly for being very clear about their wishes. If their final moments included being held captive in their deteriorated bodies, all concluded that they would want their families to pull the plug. One woman put it succinctly, "If my daughters and husband disagree, the one who votes yes wins," she said. I nodded and quietly added another stitch to the cap I am perennially knitting, but I didn't really speak up. Silently, I was thinking, oh yeah? Easy to say when you're not really in that situation yet. I think I'll just wait until the time comes, which of course will likely be too late, so I'll probably screw up my courage and write an advance directive or living will or whatever they call those right-to-die documents. My son or husband or sister will then be relieved of that horrible decision, and I will have been brave. But I think I'll just think about that one more day. I think. Therefore, I think I will put this off. This is Norma Gay Pruitt, still having her head on her shoulders for the moment, for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Paul Thompson believes that even unmentionable body parts deserve some honor. In Holy Sonnets, a meditation upon the openings of the body, Paul leads us to believe that these knotty bits may even be sacred.
Some years ago, I got to thinking about the fact that Genesis declares that humankind is made in the image of God, which means that all of our body parts, even the humblest, are sacred. Of special significance are the body openings, which allow us to interact with our environment and with each other. These musings led to the following meditation on the openings of the body, 6 Holy Sonnets. In the spirit of the last shall be first, I began with the lowest openings and ascended. The first sonnet refers to the recycling of living material embodied in the movement of carbon atoms through the ecosphere, and to the constipation from which Martin Luther suffered. 1. This porcelain throne, far from raising me, brothers me to every toad in the grass, reduces my pomp to generality. One more anonymous animal ass through which the world's carbon atoms flow in ceaseless, seemingly senseless circuitry. From butt to butterfly they blindly go, and just as blindly blunder back to me. Lord, I tried raising ladders to heaven, but reason's angels refused to climb and hurled ladders down. Yet I pray for leaven within this bread of the material world, and that I, like Luther, may find reformation even as I strain here in defecation. When we come to the second sonnet, the term vermiform, meaning worm-shaped, refers to more than the appendix. And Adam and Eve are compared to astronauts exploring the heavens when they disobey what is, in the Bible, literally the first commandment, not to eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge. 2. Regard this unruly vermiform pendant with his wise eye that cries white or yellow, now meek, now aggressively ascendant, indeed a very clever, insolent fellow. Woman-shaped just the opposite, a soft burrow for the male's worm to nest, thus inspiring many a doleful sonnet, torch songs, alimony, and the rest. When Adam and Madam ate the apricots and cowered before God in their little breeches, did he thus curse Eden's astronauts for aspiring to stellar reaches? Less majesty, indeed, and heinous, I doom you to shuttle twixt Venus and Uranus. Moving up to the top side, the next two sonnets require a little explanation. 3. Ear, so I may know how things go here, fetch me, through your convoluted way, all the gossip of this loquacious sphere, the calliopic clamor of common day. But bring me to dear dark silence, that I may listen for the word that gives worlds babbling its bottom sense, the verb that binds all nouns and adjectives, word that spoke the primeval bong-bang, word Moses heard in shrubby blaze, word dallying, dancing David sang, word of unwed peasant Mary's praise, word bleeding into wood at Calvary, the great was and am and will always be. 4. The comely dark damsel of Solomon's song declares her lover's nose to be a tower. Alas, my nose is not so boldly long, lacks all pretense of masculine power. It is a modest little sort of vent, tended to keep rain out of the passages, usefully leaning ahead to pick up the scent of food and other molecular messages. What can I say, God? It worships you in company with all my body parts, delighting in the varnish of the pew, odor of candles, and, when the singing starts, adds its resonance to mouth and throat to raise to you the rafter-ringing note. Sonnet 5 is a riddle poem. Since radio listeners don't have a chance to read and puzzle over the words, I'll give you a clue. The answer to the questions is one three-letter word referring to the function of the eye. 5. What is the artist's dominant injunction? What does the aspiring colletura reach? What is with saw always in conjunction? What wildly waves upon the beach? What is the beginning of all catastrophes? What do seduced senoritas sigh? What seat oversees a diocese? What is the principal function of the eye? Lord, this rack of riddles is poet's play, but emblematic of our larger plight, wandering in a maze through the day, pondering puzzles in the shank of night. As we gaze at the dots, grant mind's eye grace to trace the outline of your hidden face. And finally, Sonnet 6 refers to the mouth as an ape orifice that has bitten the round fruit of the world to create a mouth in the globe. Obviously, this image harks back to the first sonnet and the forbidden fruit. The host referred to in the final line you will recognize as the communion wafer. 6. Our ape orifice has bitten the round fruit of the world and carved a great mouth to natter endlessly. Radio waves shoot toward the galaxies with talk show chatter. But my problem, gracious Savior, is lack of speech. For what can this callow crow caw but lies? Not one creek, I cry, has hope to reach beyond self-serving ambiguities. And so, with dry mouth, I kneel here before you, in dusty mediocrity. Sins not high or wide enough to bear heaven's censure or celestial pity. The only chance for truth, my hands held out to hold your host. Lord, let these hands shout. For Mind's Eye Radio, this is Paul Thompson.
My favorite body part has changed over the years.
Poet Oscar Morelos.
When I was younger, it was the size of my body. I was 4'10" and weighed 85 pounds and was the city wrestling champion and the Washington Junior High School mascot, the Beaver. I was the only one who could squeeze under the fence to sneak into the semi-pro football games at Horlick Field. And if we had to have someone climb over the wall and open a gate or door, I was always the scrawniest and most agile one to do it. In the late 60s and early 70s, while still in high school, my favorite body part was my dark hair, thick, black, almost horsehair, slung over my shoulders like a saddle. And I liked the way it made a nice curl underneath each ear. I could reach up and pet my hair without using a comb. People could see me coming from a long ways away, and I was never confused as being a woman, except by my father. In college, it was my mustache, which slowly but surely grew in the space above my mouth. People always knew I was something, I mean nationality-wise, because not many people have mustaches anymore, and it helped accent my nose, which didn't need much help anyways. After college, people used to comment about my hooked nose and said it made me look Indian. Others said Greek or Italian, and no one seemed to have one like it. It was pronounced and large, and someone commented that there's a connection between the size of your nose and how well you can dance. When I moved back to Milwaukee and lived in the Spanish barrio, my favorite part of my body was my feet, because I could salsa and merengue, do the electric slide and a little breakdancing when it first came out, and learn to do the lambada, polka, and swing dance, and two-step. And dancing kept me from drinking too much and getting into trouble. When I got married, my favorite part was the soft spot underneath my shoulder, where my wife would always lay, and she never got tired of me being too close to her or complained of neck pains or reminding me that I needed deodorant. When I had my first child, my favorite part became my hands. Diego would always grab my fingers and either try to swallow them or use them to swing himself up. They would be reaching out to him like parallel bars, giving him the support he needed. When I turned 40, my favorite part was my smile, which seemed to be perpetually lit up, and for good reason, because I was happy and had something to look forward to. Since my divorce, my favorite part became my tears, which seemed to flow every time I went past my old house or saw someone who used to play with my children. And I used to be afraid of my tears and would never want anyone to see them and learn that tears can ease the pain, but only if they are released. As I edge near 50, and my oldest son is now 17 and almost old enough to know that I don't want to fight with him anymore, even if I am just trying to give him advice, my favorite part is my silence, which is beginning to help my breathing, my hearing, my listening. This is Oscar Morales for Mind's Eye Radio.
Even if we're relatively satisfied, or at least resigned to the physical shake we got from heredity, stuff still happens as we prepare to shuffle off this mortal coil. In the second half of our show today, we moil over mad cows, Kool-Aid colors, and the importance of good bone structure. Stay tuned. A middle-aged woman once confided the hilarious observation that the only good thing about being a 50-something woman was that she could now start shaving along with her teenage son. Perhaps she was being a little ironic, but her anecdote reminds us that we have all found at least one tiny flaw in our otherwise darn cute little appearances. If those ears were just a little less juggy, or those thighs a little less doughy, or that pesky toenail fungus were just a little bit less obvious, well, then for sure we'd be perfect. As we all know, if we have the moxie and the moolah, we need no longer settle for almost perfect. We can be tucked and tailored, desiccated and redesigned, so that our internal idea of our body's best selves can be made real. Women are widely believed to be the main consumers of such medical pandering, but everybody knows that the metrosexual male is catching up, sometimes with dangerous results. Evie Thompson's protagonist in the following short story discovers the dangers of concerning oneself with the superficial. And, just a footnote, it's perfectly okay to try the exercise Evie's character suggests, though you may get some odd stares from the driver alongside.
While she was washing her hands, Carol looked in the bathroom mirror. She'd learned as a small child that she was at best cute, and that her older sister was the beautiful one. But as she examined herself now, there was something that bothered her. A row of short, straight lines ran upward from her upper lip. She used to have really nice lips, but as age sucked away the tissue under the skin on her face, it was beginning to drape in these folds, and the lips had receded to a thin, straight line. "Oh, well," she said to herself, "get used to it." Carol drove to a rehab facility at the hospital, where 5 times a week she did aerobics and worked out with weights. She'd been doing this ever since experiencing some angina 3 years ago. The angina had pretty much disappeared, and often she thought of herself as completely well. Although the place had seemed drab and sterile when she started, it now felt warm and welcoming. The early morning sun painted orange-tinted patterns on the off-white walls. The grinding of metal on metal and of moving belts made the place sound like a small factory. She didn't feel anything strange or threatening about the place. It felt just like it always did. Carol liked the way the old-timers greeted each other. "Good morning, Jim." "Good morning, Don." "Mary." "Bill." "How are you doing?" "Well, I'm still on the right side of the grass." And so on. Like ants stroking each other's antennae. You could tell who the newcomers were. They looked like whipped puppies, walking around the track stiffly as if some important part of them might break. When Carol caught their eye, she would smile and say, "Good morning," hoping that would lighten their load a bit, and sometimes she prayed for them. Today, John was on the bike next to her. Retired, he had lost his wife the year before. He often talked about his grandchildren, who were deeply into soccer, and sometimes about his volunteer work tutoring Hispanic first graders. Today he seemed distracted, inward turning. Carol loved what the weight training was doing for her. Her hand touched her hip. It felt like she was wearing a girdle. "Maybe exercise could do something for my face," she thought. There had been an article not long ago in which a man said that 3 years of facial exercises had made him look 15 years younger. That could be true. And thinking back, she remembered a facial exercise she'd learned as a teenager. You formed your mouth into a Q, relaxed, and then into a W, repeating that over and over. "Damn! God! Oh, God! God! God!" John shouted. He slid from the bike seat, and as his feet touched down, he folded over onto the floor. Obscenities poured out of him. For a moment, Carol was dumbfounded. Then she jumped off her bike. She knew there were emergency buttons around the room, but she couldn't remember where they were, so she ran to the front desk. "It's John! He's in a lot of pain!" The receptionist was already dialing. Within minutes, an emergency team had taken John away. In the emptiness that followed, shocked old-timers clustered together near the desk. Carol stood next to Don, a beefy man, an accountant who exercised rigorously. "My God," Carol said. "Yeah," Don said, "hard to believe." Could this be the end, Carol was thinking? Then out loud she said, "Could it just end like this, after all our attention to exercising?" "Yeah, I know." "Then what was it all for?" "You know, I was thinking about that just the other day. I had this orange I was peeling. It had been in the fridge too long, and the outside looked pretty bad. Didn't know whether it would be worth peeling. But it turned out the pulp was not only okay, it was super sweet. I think, after the body is shot to hell, there's a part of us, like an essence or something, that goes on. I don't know. Anyway, I sure hope John's going to be okay." "Yeah, me too," Carol murmured. She walked slowly back to her bike and began pedaling. In front of her, on a bike next to the window, a woman in a red shirt was reading a magazine. The window reflected her face, illuminated by sunlight. Her concentration was lovely, a mind at work. "Lovely," Carol thought. "We are all lovely." "Well, we do what we can." Carol pedaled a little faster. Silently, she mouthed Q and then W over and over, her lips carefully forming the letters. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
The inimitable T.S. Eliot had this to say about his awkward, repressed character, J. Alfred Prufrock, a prude who's attracted and repulsed by the very real hair on the arms of the attractive society women around him in The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. "And I have known the arms already, known them all. arms that are braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight downed with light brown, braceleted and white and bare, but in the lamplight downed with light brown hair. But singer-songwriter Lynn Patrick Smith, in his love song Open Arms, has quite a different take on this particular part of the body.
The hypnotist snapped his fingers, but nothing really changed. I had almost accepted this simple parlor game charade, with fables for the privileged and parables for the poor. And then I saw your open arms, and then I wanted more. Life's ordinary carnival offers no new way to spin. And the cinema multiplex is blessed with crowds again. They are so easily amazed, even though they've seen it all before. But when I saw your open arms, that's when I wanted more. Shambles like an earthquake chandelier. Sometimes when things get shaken up, they're not as shattered as they appear. Sometimes I wondered if I'd find someone like you, who wanted more than what's popular and hoped for something true. Some stars get crossed, some stars align. This is what I was hoping for. 'Cause when I saw your open arms, when I saw your open arms, when I saw your open arms, that's when I wanted more. That's when I wanted more.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Hair dye may not be new. Even our elderly Aunt Myrtle had henna, an ancient clay byproduct known as far back as the time of the Egyptians. Not to say that Aunt Myrtle was that elderly. In each of our families was that one gone astray kid who went off to college looking one way, hair-wise, and came home looking quite another. Some of the choices today are startling, but Technicolor dreads and red Stegosaurus spikes hardly turn a head in some cities today. As for Esther Cameron, all those choices may be moving us away from the simple beauties of the shades of yesteryear, the ones still found in nature.
One thing I sort of miss is ash blonde hair, or any of the other shades of mouse. Grounds for complaint if it was yours to wear. But like the shingles of a Cape Cod house or wave-smooth driftwood, comforting to see. Its unemphatic plainness let you trace, as in good black-and-white photography, whatever was of interest in a face, a fine-drawn eyelid or a firm-set chin, and often the mute tones of hair and skin made up unique, elusive harmonies. Now everyone flaunts forth in gold and red. You see the hair, but not so much the head. I'm Esther Cameron for Mind's Eye Radio.
Perhaps more than any other American poet, Walt Whitman is a poet of the body, of every part of the body, and he writes in praise of it. And this is a selection from I Sing the Body Electric from Part 8 and all of Part 9. If anything is sacred, the human body is sacred, and the glory and sweet of a man is the token of manhood untainted, and in man or woman, a clean, strong, firm-fibered body is beautiful as the most beautiful face. O my body, I dare not desert the likes of you and other men and women, nor the likes of the parts of you. I believe the likes of you are to stand or fall with the likes of the soul, and that they are the soul. I believe the likes of you shall stand or fall with my poems, and that they are poems. Man's, woman's, child's, youth, wives, husbands, mothers, fathers, young man's, young woman's poems. Head, neck, hair, ears, drop and tympan of the ears, eyes, eye fringes, iris of the eye, eyebrow, and the waking or sleeping of the lids, mouth, tongue, lips, teeth, roof of the mouth, jaws and the jaw hinges, nose, nostrils of the nose and the partition, cheeks, temples, forehead, chin, throat, back of the neck, neck slough, strong shoulders, manly beard, scapula, hind shoulders, and the ample side round of the chest. Upper arm, armpit, elbow socket, lower arm, arm sinews, arm bones, wrist and wrist joints, hand, palm, knuckles, thumb, forefingers, finger ball, finger joints, finger nails, broad breast front, curling hair of the breast, breast bone, breast side, ribs, belly, backbone, joints of the backbone, hips, hip socket, hip strength, inward and outward round, man balls, man root, strong set of thighs, well carrying the trunk above, leg fibers, knee, knee pan, upper leg, under leg, ankles, instep, football, toes, toe joints, the heels, all attitudes, all the shapeliness, all the belongings of my or your body, or of anyone's body, male or female, the lung sponges, the stomach sac, the bowels, sweet and clean, the brain in its folds inside the skull frame, sympathies, heart valves, palate valves, sexuality, maternity, womanhood, and all that is a woman, and the man that comes from woman, the womb, the teats, nipples, breast milk, tears, laughter, weeping, love looks, love perturbations, and rising, the voice, articulation, language, whispering, shouting aloud, food, drink, pulse, digestion, sweat, sleep, walking, swimming, poise on the hips, leaping, reclining, embracing, arm curving and tightening, the continual changes of the flex of the mouth and around the eyes, the skin, the sunburnt shade, freckles, hair, the curious sympathy one feels when feeling with the hand the naked meat of the body, the circling rivers, the breath, and breathing it in and out, the beauty of the waist, and thence of the hips, and thence downward toward the knees, the thin red jellies within you, or within me, the bones and the marrow of the bones, the exquisite realization of health. Oh, I say, these are not parts and poems of the body alone, but of the soul. I say now, these are the soul. I'm Sharon Van Sluis.
Everybody has given it some thought. Just what are my final wishes about the disposition of my last earthly possession, my body? If you don't see why you can't just become useful again, recycling the only slightly used parts, you might get along with Fran Rawl, who takes a very practical approach to her demise.
For as long as I can remember, I have wanted to be buried in a blanket, to let my body go back to the soil. The poppies in Flanders Field seemed like a lovely carpet. Doris Lessing is supposed to have said that she wished to be composted. As one who composts every scrap, I heartily endorse that sentiment. It was a couple of years ago I read an article in the Isthmus by a woman from Milwaukee, Peggy Taylor. She was writing about her wish to provide more skeletons for medical schools. A person's bones have to be prepared, a process called maceration, which strips the flesh away from the bones. This idea immediately appealed to me, and I wrote her. I now have a letter in hand about her difficulties in getting any funding for establishing a national site. The Red Cross was not interested, and the AATB, the American Association of Tissue Banks, didn't have an interest in it either. She had hoped that Secretary Tommy Thompson might be supportive because of his interest in organ and tissue donation. His Department of Health and Human Services was working on this. She tried Senator Feingold's staff, but they could not find anyone interested. Then came September 11th and the anthrax scare, so she lost hope for the project. Later, someone told her of a group which might help with the AATB, so she wrote a proposal for a grant from them. However, my recent effort to contact her by email was not fruitful, though I am on her list of interested people. My last letter from her was on February the 19th, 2002. If it doesn't work out, I will offer my body to the medical school if it's acceptable. When we gave my mother-in-law's body, she was 89, but didn't have any of the problems they could not accept. So maybe I will pass muster also. I am an organ donor, so who knows what parts of me might be floating around the universe, even though I can't grace a schoolroom. Recently, I read about a cabinet the zoo uses to prepare bones in when they want the skeleton. Evidently, this is too plebeian for human remains. I suppose insects are involved. So, it's all in limbo. Maybe I can be used, maybe not. I will be dust to be scattered wherever my survivors wish. I don't visit graves, but they might wish to. A better use of the time might be to read what I have written over the years. It holds my convictions, my dreams, my wayward thoughts. This is Fran Rawl reporting for Mind's Eye Radio, looking to the future.
If you want to give your body to medical science, the Body Donation Program of the University of Wisconsin Medical School gives the following notice. Occasionally, we must refuse a donor's body in the following situations. We cannot accept mutilated bodies, e.g. automobile accidents, or bodies which have undergone recent major surgery prior to death because they do not embalm well enough for our purposes. Other physical conditions which may cause a body to be refused include obesity, malnutrition, polio victims who have lost muscle tissue, jaundice, profound cancer, late renal failure with massive edema, hepatitis, and infectious diseases, systemic sepsis, which may put the recipients at risk. Got milk? Questions the billboard in much larger than life size, while the accompanying picture, a current svelte young model, sports a milky foam mustache. Dairy and soy are being aggressively marketed these days, as are weight-bearing aerobics, especially for those dainty Caucasian women who are statistically more likely to suffer the collapse of their frames through the whittling power of osteoporosis. Writer Kathy Miner reflects upon the business of bones in our and other animal cultures.
Burials. An hour after the voice says osteoporosis, the first thing I see at trailside is bones. Some animal died here long enough ago that the only evidence of her life is a scapula, an indeterminate long bone, and fragments of rib cage. I have come walking here, as I always come walking here, to think, to absorb, to mingle with October's beauty, and to quiet what is racing around the circuits of my consciousness. Will I be crippled? Will there be pain? Will the drugs to cure this give me breast cancer, or worse? And all about me signals strength and hardness and grace. The skeleton, the sycamore, the shells cast up where someone has been digging. If I were a wilder, surer woman, I would eat them, all of them, taking their calcium, their toughness, their very structure into myself, letting them become me and me become them, as it is and ever shall be. Instead, I leave tobacco, leave words of whispered prayer, leave my fears behind me for the moment. For Mind's Eye Radio, I'm Kathy Miner.
Funny Nose.
Poet John Morgan.
Crooked little funny nose, beat up little runny nose, slightly squashed and bent, such a funny little vent. Wonder where it's been. Look at the shape it's in. I like a perfect nose and a perfect rose, but I also like a funny nose, and you've got one of those. A perfect nose is nice, but it's something rare. It's usually cool as ice and stuck up in the air. But a funny nose strikes no pose. It's just itself in sickness and in health. It does its job and tells you what it smells. It only puts on the swell when it's not feeling well. If you compare the styles of nose, more than likely, I suppose, you probably would say the perfect nose would be a runaway. But that's a stuffy attitude, and is even downright rude, for a funny nose comes close and may beat it by a nose. True, as the nose goes, you don't have a perfect nose, but a perfect little funny nose. And as anybody knows, a nose is a nose is a nose all the same, and would smell as well by any other name. This is John Morgan for Mind's Eye Radio.
So, was it finally Dick Gebhardt's missing eyebrows that did him in? And will Howard Dean's barbaric yop doom him to the heap of unpresidential timber? Is Kucinich wonderful but short? And will John Kerry get the nod because he's simply the tallest candidate? Most of us would scoff at having made our choices for such important positions on the basis of such silliness. But if we really probe, we may find out that body parts and the language they speak to us may make more difference than we think, or think they should. That's our show. Thanks for listening to Favorite Body Parts, or Hey, You Want a Piece of Me? From Mind's Eye Radio. The show was produced by Kelly Warren and co-produced by Gay Davidson-Silski. Original music by Barbara Chusett. Today's anatomy lesson was brought to you by the following writers: Esther Cameron, Kathy Miner, Oscar Morellis, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rawl, Lynn Patrick Smith, John Morgan, Paul Thompson, Evie Thompson, and Geither Valtzen. Original music by Barbara Chusett. If you'd like a copy of the show or more information, you can contact us at www.mindseyeaudio.com. I'm your host, Greg Willard, wishing you, hoping that when you look into the mirror, you're not horribly disappointed. God, lame.